From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, skating around campaign finance laws. Donors do it, and so do politicians.
It's a maximum fine of $1,000, and for some people, it's worth that to pay that fine so that your opponents don't see who's donating to your campaign before the election.
Fighting poverty and creating jobs in Detroit's Cass Corridor.
Everybody can do something, even if it's cleaning up one, small mountain of tires.
Scientists try to prove the old adage, happy wife, happy life.
You might assume that after 40 years, you know what your spouse is thinking. Well, you don't necessarily.
Plus, cool wet weather means a bumper crop of wild mushrooms.
Hen of the Woods is a mushroom that averages about 3 pounds. In our club, someone brought in a 42-pounder.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. On this first full day of fall, we are in for some perfect autumn weather. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, one time when saying Michigan weather actually means a good thing. And then we go enormous mushroom hunting. But first, with the November election just 6 weeks away, the campaign ads are omnipresent. If you wonder just who's picking up the tab for all those ads, particularly the issue-oriented ads, that answer is pretty hard to find in Michigan, where political spending rules allow quite the lack of transparency. Some say this leads to corruption. Others disagree. Chris Gouts of Crane's Detroit Business has been talking with both sides. Chris, can you give us an idea just where campaign spending laws stand right now in Michigan?
It can be hard to tell, but Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network spends a lot of time tracking these things. And from 2000 to 2012, he found there were about $85 million worth of television ads that went unreported because they were bought by issue advocacy groups or PACs and things like that, where they use those magic words where they're not telling people to vote for or vote against a certain candidate. Therefore, they don't have to be disclosed. And the way he finds them is that he either goes to or calls up the information on the individual TV stations who are required to show their contracts and receipts for these ads. So he can see that the money is being spent. We just don't know who is footing the bill to put those advertisements on the air.
We've had Rich Robinson of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network on this program very often as he leads the charge for greater transparency and against obfuscation. And he believes very, very strongly that the public should be able to see this cause and effect when it comes to public policy and who's making our decisions.
Absolutely. That's what he's done for years. And sort of the, what I call it, the anti-Rich Robinson is a guy by the name of Steve Linder, who I talked to for the story, who's a veteran campaign fundraiser and campaign finance expert, who thinks very differently in a lot of ways than Rich does. And the two have debated at conferences and things like that before. And he gives sort of the opposite view on a lot of these issues.
And so what is his view? I mean, we've heard Rich say he really fears the corruption risk. We know that the state integrity investigation done by the Center for Public Integrity, among others, gave Michigan an F on its corruption risk report card. But Steve has a completely different view.
Yeah, in a lot of those areas, he felt that the state got an A because he asked the question, okay, you can't show that there's a correlation between the two. He said, if you can, then show me the corruption. He thinks that, like the Supreme Court does, that money is speech, and so he shouldn't be restricted from being able to advocate his views or his client's views because of some arbitrary limit that a legislature or Congress puts in place, that this is something that's allowable. These aren't loopholes. People aren't doing anything wrong, per se. They're following the laws that are set in place, and in some cases there are some limits that he thinks should be either lifted or raised in some fashion, and then maybe just have more disclosure. Part of the problem that Rich says is that there are these limits in place, but they're so easy to get around that we really need to have tougher limits and a lot of disclosure. Steve sort of says the opposite, and he says since they're so easy to get around, we should just have no contribution limits. People should be able to give as much as they want, but we should be able to see who's giving that money much more frequently and just have total transparency about who's giving, no matter how much they're giving.
I know Linder made an interesting point to you about money and whether it buys voter influence. Case in point, 2006, Dick DeVos trying to topple then-Governor Jennifer Granholm. And what, he spent over $35 million of his own money, and he still lost big.
Yeah, he lost big, and then you don't even have to go that far back. You can just go back about a month or so when you had Republican businessman Paul Mitchell up in the Midland area trying to win a seat in Congress and blew through, I think, $3 to $4 million of his own money in just the course of like 90 days and got thumped pretty substantially by about 16 points by a state senator who had, you know, a lot of respect and goodwill built up in the in that district. And it just proves to you that you can have all the money in the world, but if you don't have people having a reason to vote for you other than that they've seen you on TV constantly, you know, for months on end, you're not always going to win.
Chris, what did you find are some of the ways that that lawmakers and lobbyists can get themselves and work around Michigan campaign finance laws?
Well, one way is in terms of, you know, the alcohol and things like that that they can have at fundraisers. You're not supposed to purchase or give, you know, away free beer and wine to the lawmakers. But if you host a fundraiser for a lawmaker, what typically happens is that the lobbying firm or the place where you're having your fundraiser will bill you for the amount of food and alcohol that was served at the fundraiser. And then just a couple of days later, they will donate to your campaign that same exact amount that the food is for. So basically, you have a all-expenses-paid fundraiser, and then you get all the donations that come with that. So that's one of the ways that they can work around that. Although Steve would say they're not working around anything. That's what the law allows that. And so they're simply taking, they're using what's available to them.
And then campaign spending is the way that money is spent. And you talk about how campaign masterminds know magic words in your campaign ads can make donors disappear.
Yeah, like I was saying, you as long as you don't say, you know, vote for or vote against, you can do these issue ads and have an advocacy group or a member organization, which, you know, could be, you know, the Small Business Administration or it could be the MEA. You can have these issue ads, or you can have a PAC where you don't have to disclose some of your donors. And so there are definitely ways, if you have the means and the money that you want and you want to donate to a candidate, there are ways in which you can do that despite some of the rules that are in place.
Now, we have the idea of the donor disclosure. And as you point out, in election years in Michigan, the public and political opponents get a couple of chances to see, you know, who's donating to candidates for state office before voting begins. But that doesn't always work well. And we'll point to Representative John Olumba. Tell us about that that track record.
Not a good one. he's filed more campaign finance statements late than he has on time during his time in the state legislature. In fact, he missed so many deadlines in 2012 that he missed the swearing-in ceremony on the first day of session last year because you have to submit all of your paperwork, all of your missing records, and submit all of your fines for those, which are is a maximum of $1,000, and then file a statement saying that you've done everything properly before you take office. Otherwise, you can be found guilty of a misdemeanor. And so he was having to file all of his paperwork back last two Januaries ago and then had to be sworn in separately once he finally made it over to the House. And so he's had quite the history. And during this last primary, there were 33 campaign finance reports that were filed late where the state had to go after either candidates or lawmakers and say, hey, you didn't do what you're supposed to. You need to submit us that paperwork. We're still looking for it.
Well, clearly, Representative Olumba is kind of an outlier with this, as you say, kind of the worst of that. But it does kind of show that perhaps not all of the candidates take it as seriously as others.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's something that maybe lawmakers could look at changing if they wanted to, because when I was talking for people for this story, you know, it's a maximum fine of $1,000. And for some people, it's worth that to pay that fine so that your opponents don't see who's donating to your campaign before the election. Some people and have just come right out and said, you know, I purposely didn't submit it and I'm not going to submit it until after the primary or after the general because I don't want people using that as a list to go after my donors and attack them. So I think you can make the argument that you either need to make that fine tougher or change it in some way if you really want to have transparency and make sure that we can see who is donating to campaigns and what they're spending that money on.
Chris Gouts, Crane's Detroit Business Lansing reporter. As always, thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Welcome to the first full day of autumn. And if fall weather's your favorite, you are so in luck. MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa is here now. Mark, I got into a really nice long conversation with the parking lot cashier yesterday evening about how we both adore, with a capital A, we adore fall in Michigan. And it sounds like there's going to be a lot to adore as we kick off this new season.
There will be, and, you know, over my 25 years of forecasting weather in Michigan, I think you're exactly right. Most people could agree that at least much of fall is beautiful. We've got about a 9-day stretch now, it looks like, of dry weather and fantastic sunshine, temperatures in the 70s in the afternoon and 40s and 50s early in the morning.
How long has it been since we had a good, you know, long 9 or 10 day stretch of dry weather like this?
You know, I wrote a post about that on MLive, and I thought it was going to be easy for me to do. I thought I was going to go back to sometime last year, and I looked at Detroit, and I went back to last year and couldn't find a stretch, and then I went back to the next year. It's actually been 4 years since we've had 10 dry days in a row in Detroit, and it looks like that's about what we're going to have this time.
Ooh, which no one's going to complain about, but we've had a pretty soggy summer.
Exactly. You know, that's a tough part of my job. Sometimes it's like being a politician. And very rarely can I say, hey, we all will probably agree that this type of weather is good. Most spots have had enough rainfall in the last 6 months that nobody's going to complain about 10 days of great fall, almost summery weather.
Yeah, yeah. Where are we at with fall color changes? What areas have the strongest colors right now?
Actually, I'm just posting on that on MLive now, so if you check it through the afternoon, you'll see it. The UP, I got some pictures from yesterday, the UP, the western part of the UP, is at peak right now and looks spectacular. Eastern part of the UP is maybe 5 to 7 days away from peak. And then another great stretch that I'm finding from people that have submitted photos to me, M61 around the Gladwin area, a lot of reds and purples. And everything that I'm seeing says it's about a week ahead of schedule. So if you normally say, hey, I want to go to Traverse City in the second weekend of October, I think you better inch it up about a week so you don't miss the peak color.
Oh, sounds delicious. MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist Mark Torregrossa. As always, thank you. This is a good one, Mark. No one's going to hold this one against you.
Enjoy the great weather.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, thanks to that cooler, wetter summer, Michigan mushroom hunters are having themselves a blast with a bumper crop of wild mushrooms. Philip Tedeschi is president of the Michigan Mushroom Hunters Club. Philip, we talked to you last spring about the grape crop of morel mushrooms, and now it's turning into a great fall as well?
Fall has been starting out very good. The summer mushrooms were great. We picked chanterelles and black trumpets and some of my favorite mushrooms that come up then. Right now, the hen of the woods are starting. Hen of the woods is a mushroom that averages about 3 pounds. The ones I pick are typically 1 to 5 pounds. In our club, someone brought in a 42-pounder.
Wait. One mushroom is 42 pounds?
One mushroom. The record for this mushroom comes from Pennsylvania. It's over 100 pounds.
Okay, that's like from Mars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. And the one mushroom can be turned used in so many ways in recipes.
In many ways. It's a nice tasting mushroom, very definitely a wild flavor. I'll use it in all sorts of recipes, Chinese stir fries, Thai dishes, Italian food. Very versatile.
Now I understand why my mushroom-loving friend Diana has been posting all kinds of pictures on Facebook showing things she's found, and now I'm getting what you're talking about because it was almost hard to believe that one thing could be one mushroom.
That could be one mushroom.
Well, why has the wild mushroom crop enjoyed this weather so much? What is it that mushrooms love about the wet, cool weather?
Mushrooms are even higher percentage of water than animals. They need the water to grow. I mean, literally. A dry year, we won't see very many mushrooms at all. They're very dependent on the weather, very dependent on the heat conditions, the amount of light, but most dependent on rainfall.
Would you say these past few weeks have been just ideal?
Up until about a week and a half ago when it stopped raining, it has been. Last weekend, we had a couple of hunts and didn't find much of anything. But the rain we had this weekend, it's going to be a great weekend coming up.
Now, what areas of the state, Elp, are seeing the best mushrooms?
I've picked out in Muskegon, Grand Rapids area. I've picked up around Lewiston, and we had a trip to the UP, and everything was great.
That is amazing. And now, how long will these wild mushrooms be here for the picking? Is it till the first frost, or what's the lifespan of this season for you?
Well, it depends on the weather. If we get the rains, we pick up until mid-November usually. There's one mushroom called mouse's ears that won't even fruit until there's been a hard frost. I picked that mushroom in the snow.
Oh, my goodness. And do they all have somewhat different flavors depending?
Oh, yes.
Oh, very much so.
Very much so.
Okay.
We have one mushroom out there called Chicken of the Woods that actually tastes like chicken and has the consistency of chicken breast. Genus called Hericium actually tastes like shellfish. So the flavors are very vast.
But it is worth mentioning that it's best to go with someone who really, really knows this, what's what and what's safe and what isn't, someone like
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. About 3,000 species of mushrooms that grow in Michigan, about 10% are edible, about 10% are poisonous. You really have to know the mushrooms before you try eating one.
Well, the best way to probably do that and join the ranks of Michigan's shroomers is to go to one of the events. What do you have coming up?
We have our annual Fungus Fest, which is held in the Proud Lake Recreation Area north of Wixom. We do a three-day event with a mushroom hunt on Friday, a banquet, and then a talk by one of the greatest mushroom photographers around, a man who's spent his entire life, his entire career, doing nothing but photographing mushrooms. On Saturday, we have a beginner's hunt as well as regular hunts in the morning. We have a hunt in the afternoon. We have a guest speaker who's going to talk about using taste and odor to distinguish the mushrooms. And then we have our annual potluck and a white elephant auction. Sunday, we just have a clean up the site and one last hunt.
And now that's this coming weekend.
That's this coming weekend. It's open to the public. We charge a $20 registration fee for this. That might sound high, but most of the other clubs in the nation charge between $75 and $150 for a weekend like that.
So it seems that Michigan's a very good place to indulge in one's passion for mushrooms.
It is. Our club does more hunts than any other club in the country.
Well, you can learn how to join the ranks of the Michigan Shroomers by going to their website, MichiganMushroomHunters.org. Again, that's MichiganMushroomHunters.org. And we've been talking to Philip Tedeschi, club president. So happy hunting. Good to talk with you, Philip.
Thank you.
At the beginning of summer, as he is wont to do each season, poet and writer Keith Taylor stopped in to give us his picks for a good Michigan author summer reading list. One of those picks was a collection of short stories by Lolita Hernandez. It's called Making Kalaloo in Detroit. It's winning praise for the way it explores the way people assimilate and retain their ethnic identity. In this case, the ethnic identity of the Caribbean culture, and they do it while living in the city of Detroit. Lolita Hernandez spent more than 30 years as a UAW worker at General Motors. These days, she teaches in the creative writing department at the University of Michigan Residential College, and she is with us now. Welcome.
Well, hello, and thank you for having me.
I want you to start, if you would, by explaining the title of your book, because it seems to me it really does sum up what you're saying in your 12 stories.
It actually does. There's a double meaning for Kalaloo. Kalaloo, my parents were from Trinidad and Tobago, and Kalaloo is, I always call it the national dish of Trinidad. It's kind of a soup made from a bush, the leaves of the dasheen plant, think the Edel's plant, right? And think spinach if you want to figure out what kind of leaf. So it's dark and all of that. And they make a kind of a soupy stew thing of it with sometimes they put salt pork in it. They put crab in it, which is my preference. And sometimes it's vegetarian. They put pumpkin. They put coconut milk and seasonings and so on. And most often serve it over rice, maybe over breadfruit, or just eat it like a soup. Now, the other meaning for Kalaloo is a stew mix. When you're talking about cultures and people and so on and so forth. So the title is, you know, it's about making certain foods, but there are like non-Caribbean-based stories in here to indicate the Kalaloo that is Detroit.
And boy, isn't it.
Yes, it is.
But, you know, it's interesting as I think about this. Now, you said your parents are from
Trinidad and Tobago.
And when did they immigrate to the United States and what brought them to Detroit?
They emigrated after the war, World War II. And then they ended up coming to Detroit because my brother Leo came to try and take up medicine at Wayne State University. And my mother's sister was already here. So they kind of in a little tiny island community. So they just sort of follow the migration pattern. And I wish they had stopped off at Miami and stayed there. That was their port of entry. But no, they went.
Especially in the middle of January,
yes.
Right? Yes. And, you know, when I thought about your book and your background, I think the Caribbean culture is not usually top of mind when people think of the various cultures represented in the Detroit area.
That is the absolute truth, which is what delights me so much about this book. Like, I'm pretty much known for my other book that I wrote, a collection of stories, Autopsy of an Engine and Other Stories from the Cadillac Plant. Sorry for the promo. About life, fictional stories about life in the plant, you know. I guess once I retired from General Motors, and I like to say I'm out in the world now.
On the line.
that stuff sort of was coming back to me, and I've been scribbling a little bit here and there. So I finally got some stuff together based on memories of as I was growing up in the community as it was then. And I was just so delighted because people just don't even know that. They don't know that there was all this magic and music and stuff going on in these little pockets in the city, and I love that.
And you're writing for an audience that is not going to be real familiar with, like, looking at the title, what is Kalaloo? In fact, Keith Taylor, when he talked about your book, had to go to great lengths to explain that. So you're almost teaching your readers a new language.
I am, but, you know, I have to just double back on one concept, like I'm writing for an audience that doesn't understand that. Mm. And the reality is I'm generally writing for myself, and writing for me is an act of discovery. So I was discovering things as I was writing these stories, and, you know, the language, how to use the language. You know, you don't want to get too dialect heavy, and just throwing in enough that you get a sense of the cadence and so on and so forth. And then you end up, teaching people about stuff like Kalaloo and Bulljol and Bakes.
I learned a lot.
Cricket, for crying out loud. What is cricket?
Lolita Hernandez, would you read us an excerpt from your book?
I will. You know what? Speaking of this, I'm going to read right from the beginning. It's a story called Making Bulljol. And I have three making stories that anchor this: Making Bulljol, Making Kalaloo, and Making Bakes, which is a bread type of thing. Bulljol is made from salted codfish with olive oil and different things. So, and it's absolutely my favorite food in the whole wide world. Mm. I write about it all the time. Okay, here we go, Making Bulljol. The morning was gloomy for so. By gloomy, I mean a feeling you can't quite put your finger on, a creepy sadness, a sense that something isn't right. You wake up feeling heavy, as if some kind of presence is trying to push you back to the mattress, and you have to fight in order to sit up, flop your feet over the side of the bed, and plant them on the floor. I did all that and felt exhausted, but I maneuvered my way to the kitchen to see if I could determine the weather. Maybe it was only me feeling gloomy. Maybe the day was really shaping up to be bright sun. One could always hope, after all. Where there is life, there is hope. My bedroom has a window, but in truth, I have so much junk in there and heavy curtains that I can never gauge the day from the bedroom, which faces the front. I could well go to the little living room just on the other side of my bedroom wall and push aside the drapes and open up the blinds, but that's too much for early morning. And plus, my disheveled self would be apparent to the street in case some nosy neighbors were peeping my way. So, to make a decision about weather and its relation to my mood, I have to go to the back porch off the kitchen. It's there that I determine if the world is still around and figure out what the day is going to be like. In truth, the porch is as cluttered as the bedroom. The main problem is the newspapers accumulating since before BC, yellow and looking as if they could spontaneously combust even with winter sun. Next thing is the set of boxes and boxes of rags I keep if in case I finally begin to sew again. They're not rags, you know, but nice scraps of material. I could make nice dresses and so on with them, but these days, I don't know. I don't feel to do that. When I opened the door leading to the back porch of my second floor flat, the heat hit my face. No matter, it's always hot back here, even in the dead of winter. I could go out on the porch naked and plop myself on the couch and not feel any kind of chill. This morning, I could well see how gray it was outside. Mm-hmm. This could be one of those Detroit days. You know it isn't winter or summer,
but you're not quite sure if it is spring or fall, because in this neck of the woods, sometimes spring and fall look the same. If not for the calendar, you could be as hopeful in September as in May, or as gloomy.
That is Lolita Hernandez reading from her book, Making Kalaloo in Detroit, a collection of 12 short stories. She is teaches in the creative writing department at the University of Michigan Residential College, but 33.6 years on the line for General Motors.
Yep.
Where and when did the idea that you wanted to be a writer occur?
Okay, so it wasn't 33.6 years exactly on the line. The first 5 years were on the line at the Cadillac Motor Car Plant. And then I went into the skilled trades, and I ended up being the first woman in the engineering trade of auto design and layout. And boy, that was, boy, I got stories on that deal. And they didn't want any women in there. That's actually what I was when I retired. But then in the meantime, the plant closed. I went to the tech center. Then I got involved in some UAW GM joint programs. So I finished off my career at GM, actually at a desk. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was kind of weird.
But a totally different world from creative writing.
Absolutely. But I've been writing all along. I went to work in the plant because that's what you did back then if you wanted to be a revolutionary. And so I went into the plant, but I was already writing. And my first instincts, I was writing poetry back then, and my first instincts were to write about the islands, even though I wasn't. I lived as if I was in Trinidad and Tobago because my parents were so staunch islanders. And so when I went into the plant, of course, I was writing what was in front of me, which was the line and the people. And then somewhere along the line, I decided I needed more space to write. I needed something else to happen. So that's when I started to struggle to learn how to write fiction.
And here you are. And now, talk about a writer's dream. You're teaching creative writing and helping to populate the world with more writers.
Oh, yeah, that's my goal. I especially, because Detroit's a big poetry town. I remember when I first started writing stories, you know, people in the poetry community, like, what is that stuff? What are you doing? I'm like, I'm writing fiction. And I think now people get it. And the other thing is, to quote, and I always cite my good friend Bill Harris, Detroit now is in a period of story, he figures. And I agree with him because it's changing so radically. All of the factories and that life, even though it's there somewhere, that ethos is still there. But it's, you know, it's now becoming a different Detroit. It's taking a different shape. And people like me are clinging on to stories and memories to sort of recreate what was there. And I don't know if poetry can exactly give you that same kind of space. So we're nudging our way to getting these stories out.
Marching along the path of the wonderful short story.
There you go.
What do you hope your readers will get out of Making Kalaloo in Detroit?
You know, I think the stories are universal. They're stories of love. They're stories of trying to survive. There's stories of grappling with an urban environment, and plus maybe they'll learn something about these certain groups of people, but there are other people here. And I want them to get to know something about Detroit and stop stereotyping Detroit and making it sound like we're just odd ne'er-do-wells over here clustered around, you know, the river or something like that. You know, we're vibrant people. We have a vibrant art community in all manifestations. I was just at the most incredible jazz concert with James Carter, Leonard King, Gerard Gibbs at First Unitarian Church. It was like they were jumping in and out of black holes and just making music like you never heard. That was all Detroit. These guys are Detroiters. I mean, so there's a lot going on. And so inadvertently, I guess maybe I've become a little bit of a Detroit booster.
And doing so with your writing. It's a collection of short stories called Making Kalaloo in Detroit. And Lolita Hernandez will be reading at the University of Michigan Residential College this Friday, September 26th, 5 p.m., and will be signing her book following the reading. And I just have to throw it out there that of all the stories, the one that really grabbed my heart was your story, Over the Belle Isle Boundary. I don't want to give it away, and I know you are going to be reading that.
Well, I am.
It Friday the 26th. A lovely, lovely story and a really fascinating collection. Lolita, it's been a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me here. This has been fun.
Welcome back to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Well, you've heard that old chestnut, happy wife, happy life. A new study by researchers at Rutgers University and the University of Michigan apparently backs up that saying. Deborah Carr is professor and chair at the Rutgers Department of Sociology. You aimed your study at older couples. What questions were you hoping to answer?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of research showing that one of the biggest predictors of happiness is actually being happily married. But most of this research, if not all of this research, focused on only one partner in the marriage. They looked to see whether your marital satisfaction was linked with your overall happiness. And what had been left missing was a partner's view on the marriage. And so that was really our point of departure. We know that husbands and wives often give very different assessments of their marriage. So we wanted to see how both his and her assessment of the marriage affected both partners' happiness.
And what did you find?
Well, we found a couple of interesting things. One is that we confirmed that being happy in your marriage is linked to being happy with your life. So there's that basic happy marriage, happy life phenomenon. But we found that husbands and wives' views of the marriage affect each other in very different ways. So what we found is that for a man, regardless of his level of happiness in his marriage, if his wife is happy, that makes his overall happiness and life satisfaction high. Whereas if his wife is miserable in the marriage, the man's overall life becomes miserable, even if he thought he had a happy marriage.
Why do you think, Debbie, that her view in essence trumps his?
We think there are a couple of reasons. And I think it has to do with what women and men do in marriage, and especially in this older cohort. This is a generation who had probably more traditional gender roles in marriage than those of us in our 30s and 40s do today. And so first of all, even if a man is not happy in his marriage, if his wife is happy, she may do things that enhance his life more generally. She might listen more. She might help him more with practical activities, everything from meal preparation to healthy behaviors. She might be more willing to have sex and to do so more often. So a happily married woman may confer benefits upon her husband that enhances his life, even if he's a little bit less thrilled with the marriage than she is. So there's that helping aspect. But we also think there's a second aspect, and that has to do with communication. So when you think about who is the person in a marriage who says, we need to talk about the relationship, it tends to be women. So if a woman is happy in the marriage, she will probably share praise with her husband. If she's unhappy with the marriage, you can rest assured that she's going to say why she's unhappy and will perhaps nudge her husband to engage in these conversations. So her feelings are brought out into the open, and as such, they affect the husband. You know, we don't see that happens the reverse, especially in older couples. If a man is unhappy, maybe he'll sit in his chair, maybe he won't say so much. So his negative feelings aren't being conveyed to his wife, but at the same time, sometimes his positive feelings aren't being conveyed as well.
Were you surprised by your findings?
At first we were, and like any good scientist, you run your statistical models many, many times to make sure you've done it right. And we checked this many times to ensure that we did it right. And like most studies, when you have a finding at first, you scratch your head. But then you step back and you look at the literature and you read what other people have found. And our findings do mesh with even some of the clinical literature that shows that if there's a conflict in a marriage, it's the woman who's going to be doing the raising of the conflict. The men tend to be more conflict avoidant. They don't want to talk about these issues. And especially if you've been married 40 years, like the couples in our study, you might figure, just let it lie. I don't even want to touch this one.
Let sleeping dogs lie. What
exactly.
What do you think we, as civilians, we should take away from your study?
I think a couple of things. I think, first of all, it's important for partners to talk about their relationship. And a lot of people aren't touchy and feely, and they don't want to do this. But talking about a relationship doesn't necessarily need to be bad. I think sometimes conveying what one is happy about can be very important. You know, just recapping the day, things that made each other happy. That will be one way to help ensure that whatever happiness one has towards the marriage can be shared with their partner. So I think that's important. Likewise, if someone's unhappy, I know those conversations are hard to have, but subtly and politely raising some concerns that one has and putting them out in the open might be a way to start to correct those issues. And I think if our study shows anything, it's that we're not mind readers. right? This is something we know. You might assume that after 40 years, you know what your spouse is thinking. Well, you don't necessarily. And so sometimes trying to coax out how one is feeling can be protective and good for the couple.
Deborah Carr is professor and chair at Rutgers Department of Sociology. She, along with Vicki Friedman, a research professor at the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research, proved the old adage, happy wife, happy life. Thanks for talking with us, Deborah.
Oh, thank you for inviting me on.
The Cass Community United Methodist Church has been helping struggling Detroiters ever since the 1930s and the depths of the Great Depression. That history of helping people who are poor, who are disadvantaged, continues to this day under the guidance of my next guest. The Reverend Faith Fowler is pastor of the Cass Community United Methodist Church, and she's the founder and leader of the Cass Community Social Services. Reverend Faith Fowler, welcome.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Tell me, what is your view of what's happening at the Cass Community Social Services and also at the Methodist Church?
Well, the social services is focused, since it was founded in 2002, on four areas: food, housing, healthcare, and jobs. And it's been expanding incredibly, really, all over the city of Detroit, 11 different locations, because the need has grown tremendously. At the same time that we're celebrating some really exciting things downtown with the riverfront and new businesses and new young professionals moving in, there are still large pockets of the city where people are poor and left behind, if you will, at this point, and blight and lack of transportation. So we're really trying to work with those folks to improve the quality of life.
There's a lot of conversation, and you just touched on this, that as people move to Midtown or Corktown or move downtown, fears of seeing two Detroits.
Yeah. You know, the people who are attracted to the city primarily have good feelings about coming back and wanting to help rebuild. Certainly, they're not seen as the saviors necessarily, but as part of the team. And so they're receptive to being in a diverse place, which includes economics, but also race and religion and culture. So I think as long as we keep that at the forefront, we're okay. Sometimes it gets lost.
Well, and yeah, because there's concern that what about the neighborhoods and what
right.
about these overlooked areas?
Right. In fact, you've got to do both at the same time. I think the new mayor is trying. He's put quite an emphasis on blight removal. He certainly has stood with a bus system for people, really rely on it for everything in Detroit. Half the city doesn't own a car, and then poor people are really without transportation as well. So,
isn't like there's a lot of jobs where they're living.
Yeah, yeah, that is very true, that there aren't a lot of jobs in the city proper. And all the talk about the recovery in Michigan and southeastern Michigan hasn't really impacted the city the way we need it to. So so that's important.
One of the things that you've launched with the Cass Community Social Services that really got a lot of interest all over is the Detroit Tread sandals. In fact, we talked about it with an entrepreneurial expert who thought it was a tremendous example of entrepreneurial spirit. Tell us how this works.
Well, we started picking up illegally dumped tires in 2007. We began making mud mats, which uses the sidewalls of the tires. We've picked up 40,000 tires, and the supply is infinite. So
that
so free
is.
Material. So that was perfect to begin with. But then we couldn't discover what to do with the tread of the tire because they have the steel belt in them. And getting through it required, you know, we went through all kinds of saws. We even used a machete to try and get through the darn thing. Finally, with the help of both a class from the U of M and a professor from the College for Creative Studies, we've discovered a way to take the tread of the tire and convert it into the sole of a sandal. And in it, we inserted Old English Detroit D. So we're able to say to people, leave your mark as they're walking. And quite frankly, we have a backlog because we launched them in late June. And in the first month and a half, we sold $50,000 worth of sandals at $25 a pair. And their orders have come from 46 states and three different countries. So we added a second shift. We're trying frantically to catch up with orders so that people don't get discouraged. But it's a wonderful product. The D itself uses rubber from tires and old milk containers. We thought initially we could use the seat belts from cars for the upper strap, but we couldn't come up with the quantity we needed, so we had to go to another source. But they're unique and certainly support employment in Detroit. We currently have 85 people working in our green industries, which are just jobs we made up when we realized we couldn't find people work.
And at the same time, you're dealing with the problem of the littering and the abandoned tires.
Absolutely.
You're tackling a lot of things with one.
In a city that doesn't have the money to do everything, we feel like we're helping the larger community. Certainly, we take youth groups out. Tire hunting is what we call it. No guns, no bullets, no dogs. But we go out in vans and we pick up tires for an hour at a time. And we'll pick up 100 or 200 tires, sometimes just one at a time. Sometimes we'll get a call from a neighbor or the media. There's a house with the basement crammed or the garage crammed, and by the time the kids are done, they're covered in mud. But they've seen the city, and we get groups from all over the country. So for them to see the good and the bad of the city are important as they problem solve and talk about Detroit. It's not one thing or the other. It's both simultaneously. And it's the recognition that everybody can do something, even if it's cleaning up one, you know, small mountain of tires.
I'm speaking with the Reverend Faith Fowler, who's pastor of Cass Community United Methodist Church in Detroit, and she heads up the Cass Community Social Services. And you have a new book out. It's called This Far by Faith, 20 Years of Cass Community. What are you telling readers in this collection of short stories?
Well, they truly are just short stories, and they talk about our people, they talk about our programs, they talk about the evolution of the agency, they talk about Detroit and how it's changed, again, how some things are markedly improved and how some things are still on the agenda list, or parking lot, if you will. They talk about the change even in information. You know, 20 years ago, we didn't have cell phones. We weren't texting. We weren't on Facebook. So that's all different than the start of things. And then in some places, we even talk about globalization. Again, the good and the bad. I mean, you don't sell $50,000 worth of treads just in Detroit in our community. You sell them because the internet picked up the story and it went like wildfire without a burn line. It just went everywhere so that we lost control of it in a very good way. And that's the new reality that 20 years ago we never would have dreamed of.
You know, we're coming out of the Great Recession, and a lot of people who have been working hard, doing everything right, found themselves in tough situations through those years. And I'm wondering, do you think that recession and the tough times Michigan has been through, has that helped people see the poor with new eyes?
I think so. I think it has given them a new empathy and sympathy that that life can be precarious, that things beyond your control can jettison you into poverty or a situation that is scary. And that even though everybody makes bad choices, that they're compounded when you're poor. And, you know, people lost their homes, lost their cars, lost their houses, lost their marriages because of things beyond their control. And that's what happens to poor people all the time. So, and once you've had that experience of being so very vulnerable, it makes you sympathetic in ways you haven't been before.
Are you feeling that?
Yeah, I think so. And the other thing that's coupled with that is that we have a generation of people who are retiring. And for the first time, they're retiring and their health is good and their funds are okay. So they're looking for ways to make a difference. So people come in to volunteer once a week or for weeks at a time from across the country who hadn't seen that age group before in the way we are now. And they bring with them just a wealth of experience and education, and they're making a tremendous difference.
You are going to, about to launch a tour of Michigan that's tied in with the launch of this book. You're going to be speaking in Portage, Holland, Midland, Gaylord, Okemos, and Swartz Creek.
Yeah, we wanted to see the fall colors.
Why did you pick those cities?
Well, Cass has a reputation, at least within the United Methodist denomination, all over the state. And so we tried to pick places where there's enough density that people would come to hear about it. And also, in addition to the book, the Ambassadors, our gospel choir of homeless men, will sing. And they're worth coming to hear anytime. They're very talented. And often they share some of the things they've been through and some of their dreams for the future. And It's always moving.
When we think about the kind of problems that you're working with day in, day out in the Cass Corridor, poverty, food insecurity, addiction, homelessness, it all hurts the same whether you live in Detroit or whether you live in a small rural town in the Upper Peninsula. Do you think the solutions that you're finding in the Cass Corridor are equally applicable in the UP?
Yeah, I think you always have to scan your environment to see what will work. But we have had teams visit us from as far away as Haiti and Turkey to see how they might start job programs there. For the gypsies in Turkey that I didn't even realize were a problem. Certainly everybody knows that Haiti struggles financially. But, and what I'm finding more and more as we go around is places I never expected it before. Folks are asking me for employment in very nice suburbs, in very nice sections of Michigan. So we haven't experienced the full recovery everywhere yet. That's for sure.
What's your hope for the people that you see day in and day out?
Yeah, we've got a really good board, and the next part of our strategic planning involves how we put together some jobs that are full-time with good wages, including not only homeless people but developmentally disabled people, people with autism. We're seeing more and more people with autism, as you've been reading, I'm sure, who bring a really unique skill set in terms of their ability to concentrate and zero in on problems. So we're working on some employment for them as well.
Lessons to be learned. And I'm sure you're going to pick up interesting stories and insights as you travel around Michigan as
well.
Oh,
yeah. It's always great to see this state.
Well, this coming Saturday, September 27th, there is a big celebration of Reverend Faith Fowler's book. It'll be at Orchestra Hall in Detroit. I'm sure you've got a lot of surprises and great things planned for that.
We do.
And you can learn more about this event or find out about Reverend Fowler's 6 appearances around Michigan between September 28th and October 3rd. Just go to casscommunity.org. Reverend Faith Fowler, thank you so much for being with us. And I suspect by going to casscommunity.org, those who can't make your appearances can find out about getting This Far by Faith.
Absolutely.
Good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and our engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.